You are tuned into Business Sense on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.
Let's try this one more time. Once upon a time, access to money and the systems that moved it came with a price. Geography, paperwork, networks, and often exclusions. Banks weren't built for the everyday African, especially not the unbanked rural farmer, the side-hustling city dweller, or the informal trader who built an empire without even printing a payslip. But today, the system is being rewritten in code. FinTech isn't just an industry, it's a revolution. One that is redesigning how Africans borrow, invest, insure, pay, and prosper. It is, yes, reshaping who gets to participate in the economy, but it's also revealing that we were always the economy. And tonight we go deep, not just into apps and digital wallets, but into the heart of innovation, access, and what it truly means to financially liberate a continent. And helping us do just that is a man who doesn't just follow trends, but interprets them, builds on them, and expands their impact. Njabulo Sandawana is a fintech strategist, a thought leader in digital financial inclusion, and a pioneer in unlocking Africa's unique financial DNA. His work sits at the intersection of innovation and access. And tonight we ask, is fintech just the future, or is it already Africa's present? Njabulo, so happy to have you on the show. Good evening.
Good evening. Happy to be here.
All righty, let's jump right into it. When you look at the African continent with all its nuance, its contradiction and creativity, what do you believe makes this the perfect place for a fintech revolution?
Well, I think, Africa is uniquely positioned because of the fact that we don't have clean heads, legacy, institutions. So that gives us an advantage in the sense that we can be able to leapfrog. And what that means is we don't have to rely on legacy infrastructure. We can just simply be able to solve our problems in the way that, delivers the sort of change that we want to see in our society. So I'll give an example of M-Pesa, for instance.
Yes.
It was supposed to act as a microfinance. So enable farmers that you're speaking about to be able to get loans, but be able to then repay them through mobile phones.
Yeah.
But then that then opened up, other use cases, which is they then realized, look, we can also enable local remittances or domestic remittances, and people can be able to send money to each other.
Mm.
Right? So those are the sort of use cases that then emerged from that initial problem.
Yeah.
So I think Africa is ripe for that because we don't have to, like I said, there's a lot of inequality when it comes to access to finance. And so what we are then able to do through fintech is to be able to sort of bypass all those other institutions, your banks, and people can be able to use, in the case of M-Pesa, mobile phones to be able to transact or to be able to be included in the financial ecosystem.
Yeah, and maybe before we continue, let's just draw it back, right? Because I know what fintechs are, I know what financial technology is, but I don't know if everybody at home knows what we're talking about. So, in the most simplistic but also comprehensive way, please just describe to people at home what fintechs actually are and what problem they seek to solve.
So when we talk about fintechs, we're talking about it's a short for financial technologies.
Yes.
So we're talking about your things like M-Pesa that we just mentioned, here in Zimbabwe, EcoCash, or all other types of mobile monies that people interact with,
yeah,
that enable them to transact, that enable them to send money or to receive money.
Mm.
So that's essentially what we're talking about. Finance enabled by technology.
Yeah. So it's finance enabled by technology that doesn't require people to step into a bank. Is that what it is?
Yes. So, but in some cases, you find that like it's a sort of a hybrid model. I think if you think about technology in general, it's always there always has to be, you know, a human behind it or some kind of manual process that then enables, you know, the technology to work. So, for instance, if you want, in our case in Zimbabwe, if you want to transact through your cash, you might need to go to an agent and still do that cash in.
Yeah.
But then essentially you are able to move that money without having to interact with a person, without having to handle physical cash.
Mm.
So it's essentially doing away with, the manual or the physical cash that we're used to dealing with.
Yeah, got you. In your view, was FinTech Africa's answer to exclusion, or did it become that over time?
So I think the general, some of these things are not like clear cut in the sense that, like I was saying initially with the M-Pesa example, there are all sorts of use cases that then emerge from a particular problem. So, but I think if we sort of think about it as just inclusion, then there's a problem with the way that we frame that, because it's not just about including other people in the sense that they get to, and then we will get to just charge fees from the unbanked, for instance, right? But it's also, we should also think of it in terms of giving people ownership, giving people control over their finance, not in the sense that they just receive money, but they also create value. So I think that should be the way that we frame it. So instead of just saying, okay, we're including these other people that are not, you know, part of this particular ecosystem so that we can also milk from them, or so that we can also charge them fees. You should think about it in terms of empowering people by giving them ownership and also allowing them to have to create value within that system.
One would argue that initially they were already creating value, right? And that their participation or empowerment was cash based, and now it's just using technology. So I'd love for you to unpack in what way FinTech is particularly empowering and allowing people to now add value that they weren't doing initially. So in what way is it enhancing that?
Okay, so I think the problem has to be, we have to look back at, you know, what when we're talking about inclusion or exclusion from what exactly?
Yeah.
So if we're going to use the example of the farmer, for instance.
Yeah.
It's very difficult for a person who's, let's say, informal or anyone who's in the informal sector for them to access certain financial benefits. So, for instance, they can't just, it's difficult for them to get a loan because maybe the bank will require them to have title deeds.
Yes.
It will require them to have all sorts of things.
Yes.
So then this disruption comes in order to help enable the people that are excluded in that sense for them to be able to transact. So, for instance, there's all sorts of requirements that one needs to have for them to open a bank.
Yes.
But with your mobile phone, everyone has a mobile phone.
This is true.
And the process of opening an M-Pesa account or an EcoCash account is less cumbersome than if you want to have to open a bank.
Mm.
So I think that's what's at the heart of the disruption. So it's essentially, you know, breaking down on this bureaucracy and that excludes certain people that don't fulfill a particular template that a bank might require from them.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Thank you for clarifying it. Now, I want to know, that being the case, what role do you believe trust now plays in the adoption of fintech products on the continent, especially among these communities who've historically been failed or sidelined by these traditional banks of which we speak?
So I think if we talk about trust, then, you know, trust is essentially embedded at the very heart of of finance itself. So even when you're using, you know, cash, essentially what you're carrying is a sort of assurance or whatever you're trying to, you're using that as an assurance to communicate value, right? So I think there's an element of trust when we talk about finance in general. But when it comes to people being able to apply this to fintech, I think it's a matter of educating people about what it is these platforms or these solutions are trying to solve, and a matter of telling them or being transparent about how they work. Because there's also, you know, with the rise of technology, with the rise, there've been a lot of scams around Bitcoin. Scams around mobile money.
Yeah.
And so people become skeptical and might be more comfortable with using sort of a traditional way of storing value. But I think at the end of the day, it comes down to educating people about how these platforms work and what advantage they present to them,
how they better their lives. You mentioned M-Pesa quite intensively in the beginning. There's EcoCash that you mentioned as well. I know there's a solution that was presented by SARB not too long ago, PayShop. There's Chipper Cash as well. And these are examples of Africa's fintech rising, right? And it's often hailed as leapfrogging, like you said also when we started. But what are the risks of skipping steps in infrastructure or regulation that is posed by all this technology that is coming up?
So the regulation question, I think we also have to look at it from a different angle, in the sense that regulation should not be used to sort of impede innovation or impede progress. But at the same time, regulators should not regulate the outcome per se, but they should be able to try and look at it from a point of view of safeguarding the users and also looking at how these technologies can be abused. So I think there should exist some kind of a balance between, coming up with regulation that allows innovations to still thrive, but also being fully aware of how some of these technologies can be abused or how the end users can also be affected negatively. So I think ultimately it's not just about regulating things to death, but just also finding that sort of balance.
Yeah. And in the work that you do, what are you seeing the adoption rates being? Is the adoption good of these fintech solution? And especially by those who it's actually being built for? What do you have to say about the adoption of these solutions?
Yeah, so I think, so at the end of the day, at the heart of what we're talking about is convenience, right?
Yes.
So, these sort of platforms that we're talking about, M-Pesa, EcoCash, and many others that you just mentioned, you can be able to send someone money who's in the rural areas. You can be able to send someone money who's out of the country. You can be able to send someone money who's not in your close proximity. So ultimately, I think convenience lies at the heart of these innovations.
Yeah.
And I just want to also just go back a little bit to, you know, this innovation as an idea, because I think too often we sort of think of it as, you know, magic or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But what is innovation? I think that's the important question that we should ask.
Yeah.
And the way that I would like to think of it is, when we think of innovation, it should be something that creates value or adds value.
Yes.
So there should at least be, for something to at least be considered innovation, it should fulfill, I think, three criteria. So it should be new, And it should be able to solve a real problem. And then thirdly, it should be able to create some value. So I think that's how we should be able to define innovation. It's about, you know, building a nice app, but it's actually about solving a real problem. And in this case, with the topic that we're talking about with fintech, it's about looking at how, you know, we can sort of give equal footing to everyone and how everyone can access financial services in the most convenient way possible.
Yeah. And are these platforms actually solving African problems, or are we just mimicking Silicon Valley models with local logos?
Yeah, so that one is a huge one. I think the admission from my end, you know, having been in tech, is that there's obviously that temptation from, you know, from a lot of innovators and people that are trying to build, just sort of copy and paste, and then you change a few things, you change the logo, you change the colors, and then you sort of then, you know, put an Africa tech on it. So there is that, but I think there's also a lot of organic growth, and there's a lot of problems that are being tackled that people actually face, right? So again, the M-Pesa thing, you know, it was initially about farmers, and then it evolved into something else. So we do have examples of companies that are building technology that serves their base. So I think if you are a developer, if you are a founder who's trying to build anything, I think you should always go back to the principle that I just laid out, which is you should be able to try to solve something that actually creates value. So it shouldn't be about, so innovation is not about, you know, just building a cool app. It's really about trying to unlock value and trying to do something that actually, you know, changes people's lives. So that should ultimately be the focus.
Yeah. And what sectors within fintech do you believe are still underdeveloped or underfunded in Africa, but they really hold massive potential for innovation if they were tapped into?
So the one that comes top to mind is, you know, recently my colleagues and I were actually trying to work towards solving this problem. So there's a lot of informal activity that happens, you know, across the continent.
Yes.
And there sort of hasn't been a way or a standard to be able to kind of track in a way, you know, how this money flows and the sort of economic activity that goes on there. So I think that's one area that, you know, still needs to be explored. So for instance, we could talk about things like informal credit scoring, helping, you know, regulators understand, you know, how the informal economy works, but also then helping them to build that sort of credit. So those are some of the ideas that one can sort of play with around that area. But there's also, you know, on the agricultural side, there's still a lot of gaps when it comes to financing. But now that we have, you know, all sorts of tech around measuring data of the land and the crops, the weather patterns and so forth, I think that's another area that's ripe, that way in technology can be integrated with finance, where that intersection can be explored. So I think those are some of the areas that I think, you know, still have a lot of potential.
Yeah, I'm actually so curious about that agriculture example, because the things you mentioned, like the data and the weather patterns, don't sound like they have anything to do with finance. So please help us see the link and explore that idea further with us.
Okay. So what I was talking about specifically was the intersection. So for instance, in order for a farmer to receive credit, it would be hard for them to... They have to show, let's say, the viability of their business. But with such tech now, there can be that intersection to say, okay, based on certain data about our soil samples or the weather patterns or whatever, we think that we can, you know, multiply our yield by 10, and therefore we need finance to do that. So I was sort of applying that as, you know, at the intersection of, you know, technology and culture, to say technology and finance specifically, to say that can be another intersection that can be explored.
Oh, I love
to,
that.
To serve as some kind of way of, you know, financiers to understand or to be able to fund based on that kind of that kind of information data.
So it helps bridge the gap.
Absolutely.
Got it. And you mentioned you mentioned innovation quite passionately and those three criteria, I guess, or markers of it. And I want to know from you, how do we balance innovation with protection? Because that's a big thing, right? Now people are even scared to tap into all these innovative solutions because is my identity protected? Is my data protected? And all other things that we may have not considered yet. So how do we balance the two?
So I think it's about, you know, embedding, you know, ethics in the sort of architecture that we build. So being able to, you know, to protect people's data and to be transparent about how people's data is being used. So there should be, the design should be, we should design incentives and not just, you know, put red tape just as a form of protection. So there should be a balance between, you know, regulating certain things, but also allowing innovation. So I think in this case, you know, being able to come up with proper ethical frameworks that show us how we can protect people's data and people's information in a way that does not impede innovation.
Yeah. Is that something that is currently being practiced or are we at risk? And I'm asking you insider information here.
No, I think it's an ongoing discussion. A discussion around regulation.
That's not giving me confidence. Njabulo.
You're not confident. It's almost regulation and technology these days are, you know, like siblings, you know, that fight each other all the time. Because there's always that conversation. You know, even now when I know it's within our scope of discussion, but even now with AI and all these other things, there's always a way that we also need to think about how we regulate this. Because also the pace at which technology moves, regulation might actually be slow and sometimes might come too late, right? And when we're talking about finance is a very sensitive subject because we're talking about people's livelihoods, we're talking about people's hard-earned you know, money. So there should also be a sense in which regulation should, you know, sort of anticipate even future trends and technologies that are coming so that people are protected and then and that the regulation doesn't come after, you know, a lot of damage has been done.
And I do want to park there by regulation a bit, but I want to talk about the countries that have minimal regulations. How do we ensure that users in those countries are both still empowered and protected at the same time?
I think it boils down to what I said earlier about education. So it's not just, because one thing that also has to happen is you don't want regulators that just regulate for the sake of regulating and do not understand, you know, what they are regulating for. Right? So you there should also education from both sides, on the user end of the spectrum and also on the regulator side to say, okay, this is a new technology that is coming in. How do we protect consumers and how do we, you know, minimize fraud and all these other things that, that arise? But at the same time, how do we do it in a way that does not interfere with innovation? How do we do it in a way that does not actually stop progress? So I think education ultimately is the way to be able to educate people on all sides of the spectrum that they should understand what the technology is and how it helps and also protect the end users.
And who does this education? I'm going to ask and I'm going to tell you why I ask, right? So when I was still at the bank, I was actually part of the team that ideated and put together the solution for PayShop, right? So I was well versed about PayShop. I knew exactly what it needs to do. I knew the subsects of the ecosystem and the economy that it would serve. But then when it dropped, it just landed on the apps of those who've got the banking accounts, right? And I remember this one guy saying, I need my money, but let me PayShop you, saying it to somebody else. And that person was like, what are you talking about? And I realized that for somebody who wasn't a part of that process, who doesn't really know these things, you just see something on your app and you want to interact and engage with it for the next person. But nobody has done any campaigns. Nobody has really taught people how to do certain things. So who's responsible for the education? Is it the product developers? Is it the organizations themselves? Who does this education?
Yeah, so I think, that's an interesting example. Because I think if you're building something that, you know, is going to be used by people, so from a developer perspective, you know, whoever is developing the product should be able to educate their users on how the product works, and so that they can also, you know, maximize the use of their product, but also unlock value by getting that feedback from. So ideally, when people develop, you also want to do, you know, some kind of A/B testing or some kind of, you know, user testing, just to see how the users interact and actually the problem and so on. So I'd say that would be too late in the stage if you want to educate the people at the delivery. So it's not only about just telling people about what you're working on, how it works, but it's also about like understanding what their needs are. And then on the education layer now, it then falls to you again as a product developer to be able to communicate that. But also from a regulator perspective, it's not just about learning about how a particular product works and how it's disrupting the market, but also just being abreast in terms of the trends that are happening across that particular sector. So I think it's the person that is developing the product that's supposed to do that, but also the regulator in terms of telling people. So in this case, it could be around in different jurisdictions, maybe it's different. It could be, let's say, the Ministry of Finance or the Financial Intelligence Unit in a particular country, or the Reserve Bank or whatever, just to conscientize people about these sort of technologies and the products that they're interacting with.
And I'm so glad you said that, because by my own admission, I was in the corporate and investment parts of the bank, right? So our clients were corporates. And I remember when we were developing the solution, we had the Coca-Cola in the room. We had the retailers in the room to ask, what are the issues? What are you hearing? What is going on? How can we continue to make this country a cashless society? And so even with developing the product, it wasn't just, what do we think they need? We actually did engage with them and talk to them. And I'm hoping that even with the retail bank and the business bank, those are the things that were done. People were actually engaged to come up with the solution. So I love what you're saying, that if you want to educate at the point of delivery, you're already too late. People might not even need what you're presenting to them. And the chances of them rejecting it are also so high. But if you're building the solution together with them because you understand their needs, like you said, the adoption is obviously going to be great because this is exactly what they need.
Yeah, so that's true,
And I wonder, what mistakes do you see too often, and what mindset do you think needs to be developed to truly create transformative products within the fintech space?
So I think it's a lot of things. So in terms of the mindset change that needs to happen, I think when it comes to technology, like I said earlier, things move very quickly. So what might have made sense 2 months ago might not make sense now. So I think ultimately it's about, you know, at the heart of what we're talking about is about trying to solve people's problems and not just trying to create a product for the sake of creating a product. And also not just because something, not just applying something here because it works in the United States or because it works in the UK or because it works anywhere else. So it's about really one, involving themselves in trying to understand what the people's problems are and being able to deploy resources to address those particular challenges. Yeah. So I think ultimately that should be the guiding or the prevailing mindset.
You know, when you said now, when you mentioned the rapid rates of change within the technology space, it got me wondering that is the end product then really worth it, or is the solution as worth it if things are going to change so much? Because I can imagine that, especially with developing something in the technology space, it's costly. It's not a cheap exercise. And so with all this change that's happening so quickly and all the money that's being lost, what's the incentive to keep building?
I think the guiding or the North Star that one should follow should be to solve a problem that people have, right?
Even if it's costing
but
you.
But you just have to be able to be in a space where you also evolve, right? So, for instance, if you look at, you know, products like PayPal, that was essentially being used on eBay. Like, the product has evolved so much from the time that it started.
This is true.
And is relevant to the problems that users face today. So it's about, you know, evolving as a you know, if it's a startup, it's about evolving as a startup. If you're developing something, evolving as a developer to be abreast with whatever trends are going on and the nuanced user appetites that you might have. So it's always about paying attention to those details. But that should be your North Star. You never get lost if you think about what people want and give them what they want.
Sure, it sounds like an expensive evolution, though. Yeah.
No, it's not. It's not. It might just be changing a couple of zeros or facelifting. It depends on the use case, but
yeah. I hear you. What's your response to the fear that fintech might one day become an elitist, inaccessible, or even profit-driven gimmick, rather, as the banks it sought to disrupt?
My fear is different from that.
Okay, tell us more.
I think that I'm more afraid of the sort of authoritarian underpinnings that come with this sort of technology, in the sense that, you know, we were talking about earlier, use the phrase, you know, the term a cashless society, right? Which means that, because there's sort of certain advantages that cash has. For instance, you know, that there isn't much control or oversight from the government. But then in this case, if you imagine a future where everything is centralized and we essentially transition fully to a you know,
digital
currency.
There's
also chances of certain powers manipulating or abusing that, or certain people then being excluded because maybe do not support the government's views, for instance, or maybe they are considered to be alienated for whatever reason. So there's also that risk. So I think for me, that's the fear that I have. That's sort of the dystopia that I'm sort of wary of. So, yeah, for me, that's the fear that I have.
So what keeps you in the space then? Because this sounds like a moral issue. So what keeps you in the space, in the fintech space?
Well, I think it's not necessarily a moral issue.
Okay.
In the sense that, like, I don't think there's anything wrong with the digital currency.
Yeah.
But like anything else, you are, like anything else, it can be abused, right?
Yes, that's
So
true.
there's nothing wrong with a knife. You can use a knife to cut your, I don't know which favorite fruit you like, but
Watermelon.
you can use your knife to cut your watermelon, but you can also use it to,
To cut
you know, to
someone.
injure someone, right? So at the end of the day, technology is a double-edged sword, right? So it's not a matter of something being immoral, but it's a matter of, you know, the application and the use cases or
Yes.
bad actors taking advantage
Yeah.
of it.
I can respect
So yeah.
that. I can respect that. And beyond access to money, what new financial habits and values or literacy should fintech be building into the African society?
Can you say that again? I need
Beyond just
to
access to
digest that.
money, beyond just
Okay.
access to money, which the whole point of fintech is, right? What new financial habits, perhaps, and or values or literacy should fintech be building into African society? What is the opportunity there for that? Is there opportunity for that?
Okay. All right. I think, as I said in my other response, I think it's not about only looking at people or the people that are unbanked, for instance, or the people that are excluded from the sort of current financial paradigm as simply opportunities to charge fees, but also
Yes.
involve them in the process of creating that. So I think there's also an opportunity in terms of like storing value and creating. So for instance, there are platforms that people can now use. I've got a colleague of mine that I interviewed the other time, who's I think it's called his company is called Get Equity. So they basically allow you to invest in startups. So for instance, I think those are some of the opportunities that are then opened up. So instead of just it being about, you know, transacting or about receiving money or sending money, then can also evolve to other things as well. You
Yeah.
being able to invest in companies, you being able to buy stocks, you being able to you know, to maybe even get loans and things like that. So yeah, so I think it transcends, it essentially is about digitizing the financial space, but also giving it access to other people that would be naturally excluded from that.
And as we wrap up this conversation, I want to hear from you. What is your vision for the African fintech ecosystem in the next, say, 10 years? And not just in terms of tech, but in impact as well.
Okay. In terms of my personal vision, that's a very difficult one. But I think at the heart of it, I would like to see, you know, us having more control, because what fintech allows us to do, I think, as a continent, is for us to be able to have more control of our finances. So I would also see, you know, an Africa that is fully digital, including the financial space, and people having more command of their capital, not just in terms of, not just, you know, being better users of other people's systems. So I think it's very important that we sort of establish that sort of independence on the financial tech side.
You know, what I appreciate about the conversation we just had is that you really widened our scope beyond just fintech for what we or as what we know it, right? But you allowed us to see the freedom that it presents and the freedom behind it. And as you were speaking, especially in the previous response, I got to realize that when one democratizes finance, we do more than just digitize transactions. What we're actually doing is decentralizing power. That's something you spoke so passionately about. I guess you remind everyday Africans that they can borrow differently, they can invest differently, they can save differently, and ultimately live differently. And that is the value of any innovation, like you highlighted, that it presents a new
Yeah.
thing that empowers people and allows them to interact with the world differently. So thank you for guiding us beyond the buzzword, because we hear fintech ever so often. You reminded us in this conversation that when innovation meets intention, that is where transformation is inevitable. So thank you for having this chat with us. I really appreciate your wisdom.
Awesome. I really just want to say one part in short, which is like, I think on the last question that you asked, the question should be, at the end of the day, in the next 10 years or whatever, were we able to retain African capital? Ooh. In the sense that, did African capital still stay in African hands? And if the answer is yes, then, you know, we've succeeded in that regard. But if the answer is no, then we're just sort of mimicking. We haven't really gotten to a stage of mastery. So I think ultimately, the question around technology should be us building our own sovereignty and us building a being independent from, you know, other foreign systems. Mm.
As things stand, are we inclined more towards the yes or the no? How's it looking?
I think, you know, as I mentioned in my intro, there's been a lot of inflow of, you know, there's been a lot of fintech startups that have been funded. I think as of last year, the number maybe stands north of $1 billion in terms of companies that have been funded around the continent. And fintech seems to be a better performing category than a lot of the other categories in terms of startups. So I think the future looks bright.
All right. We're not doing too shabby. I like that. I like that. Thank you so much, Njabulo. Have a lovely evening.
Well, thank you so much. Cheers. Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Adventist World Radio. From broadcast to baptism. Powered by SID Media.